Welcome to the X-Men Task Podcast. My name is Willie Simpson.
I'm Sonia Rappaport.
And today, Sonia, we have a very special guest.
Cool.
But before I announce our special guest, let me say what episode we're up to, right?
Okay, go ahead.
Good idea. We are on the 55th episode overall, the 8th episode of Season 4, Beyond Good and Evil, Part 1.
Maybe. We'll just say maybe after all the numbers every time now.
Well, Part 1 we know for sure.
Yeah, right.
As far
right.
as the episode count, that's gotten a bit muddied. But I'd like to introduce our special guest, Brian Cronin.
Welcome.
Thanks for having me, guys.
So, Brian, I was contacted by Brian's team, which made me feel very fancy. he has an exciting new book coming out shortly. It's called 100 Things X-Men Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die by Triumph Books. I have read this book. I can safely fully endorse it. it's a wonderful piece of X-Men bookery. I suppose, Brian, we're going to talk more about this book towards the end of the episode, but is there anything you want to say about it before we get raring to go here?
I mean, I think the title pretty much tells you everything you need to know about it.
Yes, straightforward title, straightforward book, and I don't mean that as a slight in any way. It's really a wonderful, easy, enjoyable read for X-Men fans, and we're really going to talk about it as we get in here. But Brian, welcome to the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you. Today we are in Season 4, Beyond Good and Evil, Part 1. Before we really dive deep, I want to know, what is your history experience with the X-Men animated series from the 1990s?
Honestly, what's interesting is I was aware of it and followed it more after the fact than when it was actually on. I think it was right around the time, literally the day it aired, I got a job at a local comic book store. And so that sort of knocked you out of both of those afternoons.
Your Saturday mornings were being spoken for at a comic book shop, I'm guessing. You know, that was actually always one of my dream jobs as a kid. Going when you'd go to a comic store, I'd see all the people working there and just think, wow, that's a piece
dream
of heaven.
Dream job, yeah.
I don't know if the experience matches the impression that it leaves on a 12-year-old, but like, how was it like working in a comic book store?
I enjoyed it. You're around old comic books, so that's really fun.
Yeah, like,
and you get to talk to people every week about comic books too.
It wasn't too annoying, like not, you know, a bunch of like 10-year-old kids picking their noses and getting their fingers all over the merchandise.
Well, there's that as well.
Right. So, how old are you when you're working at the comic store?
Oh, I was young. I wasn't much older than the 10-year-olds picking their nose in the comic store.
And do you mind me asking where you were working, like which comic book shop?
Sure, no, it's Squiggy's Dugout in New Rochelle, New York.
Wow. So yep. No hard feelings with Squiggy's, right? You're happy to give this shout out to
them? Oh,
the...
yeah, of course.
Okay, good. Yeah, you never
I still
know.
Stop by there every week, honestly.
Cool.
Oh, wow, that's awesome. Wow.
So 25 years later.
Oh, man, that's really nice. I mean, because there's some jobs I've had from my youth that I'd rather never mention or remember. But I'm happy to know that Squiggy's is in the good column. So, Brian, we subjected you to this episode. this is actually one of my favorites. This whole mini...
We say that every week.
Well, yeah, that's true. We're really suckers in the bag for the
show. Every time we watch one afresh, we're like, oh, this one's the best.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah, so this one, one of my favorites personally, like, I think it's really insane and fun, and there's a lot to talk about. Although, I was doing a little bit of research for it, and it just seems like the internet... opinion of this Beyond Good and Evil series is not that high. And also, I read in the previously on X-Men book, another X-product, X-Fans, by Eric Liewald, that he was also not so proud of this Beyond Good and Evil series. Like, the network made them make some changes at the last minute. And actually, weirdly enough, Beyond Good and Evil was originally slated to be the series' conclusion.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, but then Fox kept ordering more episodes. So, but I'm surprised to read that people didn't, like, react to this one too well. Brian, like, in you rewatching at least just this one episode, did you, like, have any strong feelings one or the other, or was it just kind of, you know, standard par for the course?
I thought it was a fascinating, almost, encapsulation of what 1990s X-Men comics were like, in the sense that we're now 4 years into the series, and they have their own continuity build up.
Right.
And So they're now just as incomprehensible as the comic books are.
That's a good way of putting it. You know, I've read through your book. Like I said, it's really good. We'll talk more about it later. But, you know, feel free to, like, drop any, like, comparisons, X knowledge from the next. Any, like, obvious inspirations you see that we might, like, miss. Like, my X-Men history as far as the comics goes and the continuity is, like, famously jumbled the older I get. So if there's anything I miss along the way that you catch that's glaring, just please just drop in, you know, anything you want to say at all, okay? Yeah, so, well, speaking of which, like, is this is wholly original, right, in your impression? This isn't, like, ripped from some famous storyline?
This is wholly original outside, I guess, of them ripping off Aladdin.
Please explain.
Well, with their brand new Breaker, is that his name? Breaker?
Oh, Bender, I think.
Bender.
Yeah. He's a very Robin Williams-esque character.
Aladdin must have just been recently around this time, right?
You know, I always wonder this stuff. Like, there's a lot of those coincidences where there's things famous in pop culture at the time that they reference or they're either ripping off directly. But, you know, with animation schedules where it takes a long time to make an episode, I'm always surprised to think that they would be able to drop in a reference that quickly. But,
well, Aladdin would be, what, 93, 94?
Well, now you're speaking to my jumbled brain, so...
And I think this is, like... Yeah. And this is like 96, so...
Right, yeah. So, okay, yeah, you're right, yeah. It definitely, they ripped off the Bender from Aladdin, right? That's Robin Williams' character, like, right there. I'm just going to go fully along and agree with you on that. So, but nothing, like, really... There's no apocalypse plot line where he was trying to take over the axis of time, spoilers, in the 90s. You know, I don't remember many of the apocalypse comics from that era.
No, this is new. The only thing, there's to a certain extent, I think they're sort of adapting the... After Jean and Scott get married in the comics, mm-hmm. they do go to an Adventures of Cyclops and Phoenix miniseries, which sees them go into the future, they fight Apocalypse. Right. So there's a vague...
Yeah.
A vague, vague connection, but not really at all. This is pretty much 95% new.
Okay, very cool. Does that have to do with Strife and their misbegotten son, or is that something else?
Yes, that is also the miniseries where we actually learn where the name Cable comes from.
Oh, really? Oh, really? Tell us where the name Cable comes from.
Cable, and this is totally, obviously, no one could have guessed. Everyone, when they heard this, like, oh, obviously. Everyone knew this is what... Cable is because he meets Jean and Scott, who are from the past, and he eventually comes from the future to the present. He is therefore a cable between the past and the future.
Oh,
what?
Hey, Scott Lobdell had he had a name that he had to come up with some explanation for.
How basic Cable's name's origin.
But I'm.
You got that, Sonya?
Yeah.
Wow, that's interesting. Oh, I didn't know that. That's cool.
Oh, so do we find out his real name, too?
Yeah,
or?
We know his real name.
Yeah, okay.
He's a Summers.
Right, but, like, is that the like, series that gives us his real name?
That series sort of explains, like, the backstory. Basically, Cable had such a convoluted backstory at this
yeah.
point.
Right, yeah.
That they had to have him
do that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Okay, so let's just dive right into it. This episode opens in Cairo, Egypt, 3999 A.D., we've seen the future before in this show. It's really, like, presented as a terrible hellscape. I don't know what Cable is fighting to defend in his future in many episodes.
I don't think Cable knows what he's fighting to defend a lot of times in his future, but go on.
Yeah, so I was just surprised to see, when we see Cairo, it looks like a fairly non-destroyed city. And there's actually some plant life and shrubbery going about.
Right, this is the first, like, non-completely apocalyptic future that we've seen, right?
Yeah, it does seem like there's something worth saving.
Right.
Including Cable's son, Tyler, who we've seen in a previous episode, and he was, like, 10 or 12 years old. And now he's one of the few X-Men characters that have aged in the subsequent season since we last see him. So that's kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. You don't normally see cartoon characters age that much. Brian, is Tyler canon? Is he from the comics, or is he also wholly made up for the show? Or do you not know? I don't mean to put you on the spot.
No, he's canon, but like lots of Cable's backstory, it it went off in bizarre direction.
Do you know if he's a mutant?
Well, he's not even Cable's son. That's what ends up being.
Oh, I see. Okay, all right.
He ends up being like adopted, and it turns evil. He goes back in time. It's a whole mess.
Whoa.
Well,
that's Cable in a nutshell, really.
Yeah. The world's gonna really get to know more about Cable soon, like
right.
in 2018, because the Deadpool 2 movie is gonna feature what's that actor?
Thanos.
Yeah, right. Thanos, the guy playing Thanos, James Brolin, right? That's his name, Jimmy Brolin.
Josh Brolin.
Josh Brolin. All right, yeah.
I think that's his father, James Brolin. Oh my god, yeah. I'm confusing things. Yeah, Josh Brolin. He's playing. Cable in the movies, and he looks like pretty like comic book accurate as far as we've seen from the trailers, but
that really does, yeah, definitely.
We have no idea, Brian, like how like comic book accurate they're gonna get with his backstory and his mission, whatever it might be, but based on what you're saying, it seems like it's so convoluted that they could really take it in any direction, right?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah,
I mean, to a certain extent, see in the beginning, like the dude with the open shirt, you know, all the robot.
Right, yeah.
All those characters were established in early Cable stories as being people he fought with in the future.
Did he have
so that part?
Was
is
it like
at least
a team, or was it just like it
like
was
a team
an X-Force,
of
right?
No, it was like just a team of soldiers that he fought with.
Oh, interesting. Okay, yeah. And is like Cable like is the cartoon accurate in that the typical Cable plotline is that he's fighting Apocalypse, or is he like up to a lot of different things?
That's his main thing, yes, that he fights Apocalypse. Like that's in theory, that's his whole purpose in life is defeating Apocalypse. That's why he goes back in time to defeat Apocalypse in the past when he's less powerful.
Oh, that's interesting. So it's actually another like hallmark of the show that they were able to pull from the comics pretty fairly accurately. Not obviously 100%, but they were pretty like, you know, current with things.
Oh, definitely.
At the time. Yeah.
Then they have the Nasty Boys in here for crying out loud. You
know? Where do the Nasty Boys rank for you on like your list of like bad guy group competency?
I mean, they're lucky to even be on the list, I guess.
They're pretty low on the spectrum.
I mean, they're a Peter David flat out just, you know, making fun of supervillain teams.
Right, yeah. I always describe them as a rejected Prince like backing band or something, you know, from Minnesota.
Right. Yeah, the guy with the long purple coat.
Right, yeah.
The Australian accent.
They just remind me
of the accent, right.
Yeah. Yeah. They just remind me of rejects from Purple Rain. all right. So the plot is like is pretty basic again, in the sense that Cable is going after Apocalypse. He's trying to hit him at the source of his power, which conveniently is located in a big castle in Egypt that has Apocalypse's face carved into it. Like more of like a fish-like version of his face, it looked like.
Yeah, very subtle.
Yeah, you know, Cable is always in a desperate, crazy mode. He's presenting this as like the mission to end all missions, more or less. He's ranting about how Apocalypse has tormented humanity for over 5,000 years. So I like this mission. It's like a classic X-Men mission in the sense that it's just a direct frontal attack on a base. I feel like that's like
a specialty of theirs.
Yeah, I feel like that's like a classic move of the X-Men, just blow through the front doors and, you know, hope for the best. So, you know, they're barging into Apocalypse's chamber. The reason they're doing it now is because Apocalypse is regenerating his life force, which he has to do occasionally.
In a Lazarus pit, they say, right?
Do they?
They say something
Lazarus
about,
chamber,
like,
yep.
The Lazarus chamber, and we both were watching it being like, Ra's al Ghul, is that you? Like,
yeah, anyway. A weird parallel to Ra's al Ghul from
Batman.
Right.
Yeah.
Also made famous in the animated series.
Yeah.
It's weird how stuff like that would cross over in a kid's mind, you know, because those Ra's al Ghul episodes came out around the same time as these X-Men episodes, and they're both talking about Lazarus pits and villains that live
and
beyond
like
their lifespans.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like weird how a kid will connect those things, but they're really, I guess it's just more of a coincidence of comic book trope telling.
Oh, it's totally. They all have the same influences, so.
Right, yeah.
Like when Swamp Thing and Man Thing came out around the same time,
yeah,
and people are like, "Well, who came up with it first?" And then I think Roy Thomas had a great line. He goes, "They're both just ripping off the Heap, an old '40s character."
I did not know that.
What a name.
If you ever look up The Heap, Google The Heap, you'll see it's basically Swamp Thing slash Man Thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of an interesting thing about DC and Marvel in general. There's so many analogous characters that are basically all ripoffs of each other in different ways. I mean, what's most famously, like, Thanos and Apocalypse come to mind. No, not Thanos, Apocalypse. They're both Marvel. Darkseid and Thanos come to mind, right? Aren't they essentially ripoffs of each other?
Well, no. Thanos was Jim Starlin came up with some characters. He was doing a class. He was actually taking a class after he got back from Vietnam.
Wow.
And he was taking some classes, and he learned about some. He was taking some psychology classes and learned about fear and psychosis and stuff like that, and decided to base a character on the idea of like a fear character. And so he designed this Darkseid guy. But he had a more of like a spindly character, like Metron from the New Gods. And Roy Thomas once again said to him, "If you're gonna rip off a New God, rip off the cool one." So he redrew Thanos and made him look like Darkseid, and the rest is history.
Wow, So there's a lot of like weird creative crossover in the DC Marvel universe, and I don't mind. I actually find it.
Look at pop culture, George Lucas. How many different sources was he going through?
Well, you know? I mean, isn't Darth Vader a ripoff of Doctor Doom, essentially?
There's so many. I mean, George Lucas, you'd have to have a list of all the things that made it into Star Wars. So.
Yeah, right. I mean, I read, like, the secret history of Star Wars, and I found it interesting how much George Lucas took from comic books. Everyone always talks about Flash Gordon, but he really did, like, he was reading a lot of comic books at the time, too. And, you know, it must have been kind of shocking maybe for Jack Kirby to see, to watch Star Wars and probably, like, be silently cursing to himself. Although, I don't know, he probably did that, like, many times in his life based on the ways he was ripped off.
Well, funny, at the end of his New God storyline, he was going to have basically the end of Return of the Jedi with Darkseid and Orion. He sees Return of the Jedi and he says, "Everyone's going to say I ripped this off." so he just changed his ending from that point.
Oh, my God.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Okay. So that's all interesting. And folks at home, you can already get a taste of Brian's expertise here. Brian, it really is awesome talking to you. I just had a feeling after reading your book that I'd be able to sort of ask you anything and you'd be able to just roll off these things off the tip of your tongue. You're bringing a lot of authority to a podcast that is otherwise like
not authoritative.
Right. I think so. Yeah. I was going to say something way worse. We get another, speaking of Lucasfilm, we get a weird Indiana Jones reference, or just a funny one where they trip like a laser beam alarm in Apocalypse's chamber. That's not what I'm talking about.
No, they're trying to find Apocalypse's chamber, and they find out from like his
computer
cube that it's the snake hieroglyph that they have to press, and he looks at it and he goes, "I hate snakes," and he does it in like that Indiana Jones voice.
Right, but. Yeah. So another funny little reference. And then Apocalypse comes out, surprise, he comes out blasting a cable. He is not really doesn't look like that weakened by regeneration. I just want to point out, we haven't really talked about it, but I love the voice acting of Apocalypse. It's done by an actor named John Colicos. I hope I'm pronouncing his last name correctly. This guy gives a powerhouse performance of Apocalypse's voice. It is seared into my brain and imagination, I'm sure many X-Men TAS fans. And interestingly, this guy, he was like a big-time Star Trek actor, famously playing the Klingon Core in the original series, and then reprising it in Deep Space Nine. But, I mean, I just really love the Apocalypse voice. You know, and honestly, like, you know, X-Men Apocalypse, the movie, had its problems. But for me, one of the biggest problems was reconciling Oscar Isaac's voice with John Colicos' performance. Brian, I don't know, how do you feel about this performance of Apocalypse? Do you think it's too cartoony? Do you think it's right in the nose? How do you feel about it?
I think you're fair. I think it's right on the nose. That's the megalomaniacal sort of over the top. That's what you want from Apocalypse.
Yeah, I mean, I just feel like Apocalypse is a ridiculous character in general. I mean, his name is like, speaking of right in the nose, it's that. I think this actor brings so much gravitas to this character. Like, he makes Apocalypse way more interesting than maybe he has the right to be. I mean, I don't know, how do you feel about Apocalypse as a character in the comics? Are you a fan of his, or do you think he was overrated, or how do you feel about him?
I think he's good, but what's interesting, as you mentioned, it's kind of interesting, there's not as many great Apocalypse stories as you would think.
Yeah. I remember not being, because I loved Apocalypse from the cartoon as a kid, and I, you know, went back and read as many comics as I could. I remember being kind of bored and not, like, as enthralled with the Apocalypse plot lines as I thought I would be. I was, I don't know, it was either a little confused by them or just bored or whatever it is.
Well, I think part of the problem with Apocalypse as a character in storytelling is that he's too powerful. So he's not going to have a lot of depth. He's not going to be relatable. Like, one of the things that makes Magneto such an attractive supervillain is that he has so much humanity, because, like, you see that he, like, was a Holocaust survivor, and, like, he has this, like, long friendship with Xavier. Like, there's a lot of meat in the character, whereas Apocalypse is kind of, I mean, for all intents and purposes, like, an all-powerful robot, so, like, you're not going to relate to him, and it's also going to be really hard to come up with plot lines where the X-Men can believably defeat him, you know? Like,
or why isn't Apocalypse just killing them all instantly?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, didn't he have it? Isn't there an X-Men episode of the show where he basically, like, one of the time travel with time fugitives? Does that sound right?
Yeah. He wipes them out in an alternate, like, timeline, and Bishop goes back, or Cable goes back and fixes everything. So it's interesting, because in that moment he just fires a gigantic purple laser beam at all the X-Men and disintegrates them all at once, which makes you wonder, like, why he doesn't do that in future episodes or in previous ones,
like in every encounter with them.
Yeah. So I mean, I don't know, like, just to wrap a button on this Apocalypse discussion, where does he rank, like, in your X-Men villain list? Is he in the top five, you think, or?
I guess you'd have to be. So, I mean, it's almost like a de facto thing.
Right, yeah.
Because Magneto is, like, every spot, more or less.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah, okay, yeah, interesting, yeah.
Although I think the funny thing about Apocalypse also is that if the guy is all about survival of the fittest,
yeah.
I think I mentioned this in my book, he never wins.
Yeah.
Yeah, inexplicably, he never wins.
Well, it's funny you mention that. That's a good transition here, because Cable sort of puts Apocalypse on the spot and makes him do some self-reflection here. He calls him evil, and Apocalypse starts, you know, in getting introspective. He says, evil? I'm not malevolent. I simply am. And then he sort of, like, stops to think about it more. He says, but, you know, why haven't I won yet? It's been 5,000 years, and I'm still fighting you filth. So I was so, I find that so funny and smart that they would give Apocalypse some self-awareness, because you always wonder with your supervillains, like, how they just keep carrying on without acknowledging that they're always losing.
Yeah.
I guess in here, no one ever, he has a lot of yes people around him.
That's right. Yeah, who's going to tell this guy to, like, think twice about it? Who's going to have, like, a nice game of chess with him, like Professor X has with Magneto, where they can discuss the issues of the day?
Well, listen, he really needs that, because he's, like, going on about how he's not malevolent, he just is, as he's attempting to kill this guy, and, like, killing is inherently evil for living beings.
Well, according to you, you're not a timeless, like, super god that sees beyond morality.
All I'm saying is he needs more than self-reflection. He needs, like, to
some therapy or something.
Really have some, like, serious think time on, like, the nature of good and evil.
Well, I mean, that's the name of this episode, Beyond Good and Evil. Yes. So we're getting a hint of Apocalypse's thinking just by the title alone.
All right.
That morality.
I thought they were referring to Bender.
Oh, that's interesting. Well,
no, I don't think they're talking about that. No.
Well, but in a sense, he's another character beyond good and evil. He's kind
that
of,
is true.
He's like an amoral weirdo imp, you know. So we'll get to Bender. I'll try to keep pushing through here, Brian. So Apocalypse, like, always has interesting things to say in the show. His philosophy I find interest, like, endlessly fascinating. At least I do personally. So he steals Cable's time travel cube and decides to start traveling back in time. Cable and his team is surprised by this. They have no idea what he's up to or what he's doing. And here's where the show, you know, really, like, falls back on strengths with the strong continuity they build up in its own little universe. They flash back to a previous episode this season for One Man's Worth, which is sort of like the mini Age of Apocalypse ripoff. Mini series. So they travel back to 1959, where we get young Professor X in his dorm room. There's just an encounter with Bishop, his sister Shard, and the alternate X-Men from a dystopian future, Storm and Wolverine. So they catch us back up on that, and Bishop's leaving this adventure, which we saw him leave in a previous episode, and now he's, like, casually traveling, like, back to his own time he's from 2055, and he's sort of blown off course by Apocalypse. And this is why I love the show, because their depiction of time travel, the physical manifestation of these like completely zany abstract concepts, they fully realize them as much as possible. And I guess my question to you, Brian, is like, how much does this match up with your view of time travel and the fourth dimension?
My personal views of
I'm putting you on the spot.
Of what it looks like to travel through time. Yeah.
Do you picture a more Bill and Ted time travel thing, or like a Back to the Future, you know, something from Star Trek?
I don't know what I exactly picture. I doubt I imagine falling through spirals.
Actually, now that I mentioned, this is like, it's kind of the way they depict it in the show, it is kind of Bill and Ted-esque with like the way, like the spindly electric like spiral things and rainbowy,
no phone booth but same tunnel,
right? Yeah, it's a similar tunnel situation going on. I don't know how like one like Bishop doesn't get entirely irradiated by traveling through this nether space, but I do love seeing it. So Bishop is blown off course. He's kind of like sucked out of the main time spiral portal, and he lands adjacent to what is referred to as the axis of time. Mm-hmm. So I love that already, that he doesn't go to the axis of time, which, spoilers, that's where Apocalypse ends up. He's kind of next to it. He's like in the...
He's on the Rainbow Bridge.
Right. He's on like the behind-the-scenes like control panel area. And that's where he meets this magical imp character named Bender, who Brian already described as a ripoff from Aladdin's Robin Williams comedy. So right, and it's like, it's not, I know it looked, they look like rainbow bridges, but I don't, we shouldn't confuse the audience. I don't think it's the same rainbow bridges that connect Asgard to Earth.
Yeah, no, I don't think so.
Right, yeah. So I mean, I don't, you know, there's not much to say about this other than that it's like, you can either see it as totally stupid and wacky or awesome. I tend to land on the awesome side. Like I said, I just love seeing all these totally insane abstract things realized by an artist, and that to me is like, it's not only a touchstone of the show, but it's a nice touchstone of the Marvel universe in general. I think I think you see a lot of that stuff in the comics, and these are a lot of concepts that are discussed in a lot of different Marvel comics. Is there any, like, do you have any recollection, Brian, from the comics of like things like this, or is it too like crazy to even remember?
What? I mean, Bishop has traveled through time.
Right, I know, but I mean, like, time traveling, I mean, like, the veil behind time travel, kind of.
Well, you know. I mean, we won't spoil the ending of but we eventually see who Bender is.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And it's someone who is an established Marvel character in that sort of a setup.
Right,
outside of time.
Yeah.
Managing time, that sort of concept.
I mean, I love all those. I've talked about it before, all those like cosmic Marvel ultra beings, you know, I can never get their name straight, but there's like Eternity and who else? Like, is the Beyonder one of them? Or
I mean, there's so many kinds. Yeah,
there's like you know, like Death is one, and it's just like, I love that whole like hierarchy they set up, and like here we get like a little bit of a taste of that in a sense, like not entirely, but that beautiful like psychedelic cosmic Marvel world.
Mm-hmm. What's actually funny, one of the most I guess infamous comic books, Marvel comics of all time, takes place in essentially a world like this, where the son of a Time Lord has been checking out Ms. Marvel from this little outside of time.
Right.
And he's been watching her, and he brings her to his little world and uses his machines to make her fall in love with him. But he can't get to Earth, except he comes up with the idea of impregnating her with himself.
So
she gives birth on Earth. the baby grows to adulthood, and then the Avengers mess with his machines, and they have to go back. And they're like, "Okay, yeah, that makes sense. You guys are in love. He told us that his machines made you fall in love. But we're cool with that. That doesn't sound weird to us." And so, of course, fans went crazy. And one of the people who really looked at it and thought that this was a terrible idea was Chris Claremont.
Really?
So he actually wrote an issue of Avengers, an annual, the one that introduced Rogue, brought her back and had her dress down the Avengers, like, how could you guys send me out with this guy who said that he was manipulating me. And the Avengers had to be like, oh, we're sorry.
Oh, wow. That is awesome. That is a great deep cut. That's what I was looking for when I asked you that very, like, non-specific question. So I thank you, Brian, for tying us back into something relevant. That's really cool. So essentially here, Bishop's been... He's been kind of knocked out of the action for this series, more or less. He's trapped in this weird, like, Nexus place with this crazy Robin Williams character named Bender, predating Futurama. Does Futurama take place in the year 3999 or in the... I think it takes place in the year 3000.
Yeah. I buy that.
Right, yeah. I think it's in 3000. So it's a Futurama actually 1,000 years before Cable's time.
Yeah.
But that's just a side point. Anyway, so Bishop's kind of like... He's going to serve as our... like weird observer of all the weird convoluted events, and he gets to view them through these floating time mirror televisions that are like
that he inexplicably like tries to shoot at first.
What was the upside of if that had worked? What would have happened?
Yeah, exactly.
I think he thought, and I'm being totally serious and literal here. I think he thought that his laser beam would travel and shoot whoever he was looking at. I forget if it was Mr. Sinister or Apocalypse, but I think he had the good intention to just try to shoot them through a time mirror.
First he tried to jump into it and then got knocked back.
Right, and then shoots it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway.
Well, anyway, Bishop is observing a different time, the infamous present, which is now woefully in the past. Scott and Jean are giving their marriage another shot. Their first attempt at marriage in the X-Men show was... invalidated by Mr. Sinister's doing. He had Morph pose as a priest, and so I guess that technically didn't make the marriage legal. Though, why not? I mean...
Morph is not ordained. This is a family show, okay?
I'm just wondering how religious they are, if that was the issue. Brian, do we know if Scott and Jean have a religion, or are they pretty agnostic?
Wow, it's a good. I think they had a priest at their wedding, so they're. I guess there's some sort of religion.
Yeah, something. Okay, yeah. Let's not dwell on that too much. So they're having a second wedding, unlike their first wedding in the show, which had a garish like neon purple theme to all the outfits and clothing. This one has a more muted peach theme. Mm-hmm. Sonya pointed that out to me. Wolverine, again, predictably sad at the marriage of Scott and Jean. You know, it's funny, they really play up the love triangle, or at least Wolverine's sadness that he doesn't get to be with Jean in the show, but Jean doesn't ever really reciprocate Wolverine's feelings like she does in the movies or in the comic books as much in this show. It's like, it's pretty... Wolverine's really like a...
It's really one-sided.
Yeah, he's a real, like, just loser. Loser, I guess, yeah. In love, anyway.
Well, we've seen, like, his past relationships and stuff, too. It doesn't really make sense that he, like, is stuck on Jean, especially because she doesn't reciprocate, and here she's, like, getting married, and...
Yeah, she's still not over Cyclops. She's still very much into him.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's weird in this show that they even bothered bringing up the fact that Wolverine pines for Jean Grey, because they never even bothered to do anything risque with it whatsoever.
Yeah, of course... family show.
Okay, fine. Very well. All right.
I like Wolverine cutting the cake, by the way. I love Wolverine cutting the cake.
Do you also
were those claws? I just stabbed a guy, and now I'm cutting your cake.
Yeah, well, I wonder if those claws self-clean themselves when they go back into his body, if the microorganisms, you know, wash away all the germs and whatever else.
Yeah.
Tell that to anyone after they have the cake. That makes sure.
Also, Brian, interestingly, the cake has... a neat little decorative X's on it too. I don't know if you caught that detail.
I wonder who decorated the cake. That's a good question.
Are there any famous X bakers in the X-Men universe that
seems like an activity Jubilee might do?
Yeah, maybe, at least on this show.
Yeah,
I like Jubilee rocking her sunglasses on top of her dress, you know.
That was nice. Yeah, I didn't pick up on that detail. Cool. And Rogue catches the bouquet, and she expresses a little bit of sadness that she feels like she'll never get to have true love.
But we just saw that she was madly in love with Gambit in the last episode.
Yeah, her and Gambit seem to be pretty hot and heavy as the show progresses. They really establish that they have a real romantic bond. So
yeah,
I don't know. I guess that, you know, they haven't figured out a way for them to have a version of safe sex yet. So,
right.
As much as we've speculated how that could be possible. You know, Brian, I haven't really kept up on the comics past Joss Whedon's you know, run in the, like, 2005 or whenever that was. Does Rogue's powers, like, radically change, right, as in more modern times?
Yeah, she's gone through lots of different, because the key thing is that her, what we think of as her most famous aggressive offensive powers, the flying, the super strength, that all came from that Avengers annual I mentioned to you.
Right.
She took them from Ms. Marvel.
Right, as this show also faithfully, well, not faithfully, but it recreates in their own way.
Right.
Go on, yeah.
So, eventually, she lost that. And then you saw for a while the writers just not knowing what to do with it.
But
for a while there, she had Sunfire's powers, which just made no sense.
Right, yeah. Well, I guess then she still got to fly.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
More recently, she absorbed Wonder Man.
Oh. He's sort of a more obscure character, right?
He's an Avenger, so he could fly and super strength, so that was their way of, hey, basically getting her back to the Ms. Marvel setup.
Right. Do you think Captain Marvel's not the same as Ms. Marvel, right?
Yes, yes.
Oh, they are the
one
same.
The one that's getting the movie, yeah, yeah.
I wonder if they're... you know, if this Disney-Fox merger goes through, I wonder if they're going to, like, work that into Captain Marvel 2 or 3, you know, whatever that comes out. Hmm. I think they're going to have to go there.
Now, I don't know. It involves her coming back from where she gets mind-controlled and sent to in limbo. So,
wait, what do you mean by explain that?
Well, that's how Rogue finds her.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
So, and I don't think they're ever going to touch that story in movies.
Well, the point is, I need to see a more classic version of Rogue on the big screen at some point in my life.
Gotcha.
And it's like, I need this to happen. You know, it's like, she's like one of the... It's weird how they... I feel like they kind of messed up Rogue in the Fox run of Marvel movies. I mean, Fox run of X-Men movies. She's just too wimpy and lame. I need to see the strong, powerful, sassy Rogue that's essentially like a slightly depowered Superman flying around the screen. I think that'd be really appropriate for this day and age, personally. I don't know how you guys feel about that.
Yeah, I mean, that'd be cool.
Okay, all right. Maybe it's just me. So, Scott and Jean get married. Some people are sad. Storm jinxes them almost immediately. She says, oh, this marriage is bound to work out better than the last one. And then they're immediately attacked by the Nasty Boys. The X-Men sort of, like, pathetically knocked out of the action right away. The Nasty Boys have their way with the X-Men, and they can't even get on the scene in time. I was sort of shocked watching that. I thought something else would happen where... like, the X-Men didn't even see that they were attacked, but I was surprised that they see them get attacked, and then they're just sort of knocked out. That was kind of shocking to me. So, but the Nasty Boys attack their Mr. Sinister's gang. They're after Jean Grey, not Cyclops. They throw her through a time portal. Jubilee wants to help, but Professor X, like, weirdly and urgently tells her to get rid of the guests.
Yeah.
I thought that was a little strange. That was a weird beat. The X-Men are sort of baffled as to what's going on. Professor X retreats to the war room where Cerebro is, and that was kind of a setup in itself because Mr. Sinister's there is waiting for him, and he, you know, goes about trying to kidnap Professor X. So I wanted to ask you, Brian, much like how we talked about Apocalypse, what are your thoughts on Mr. Sinister as a character and, you know, as a good character or bad character? You know, what are your Mr. Sinister thoughts?
I think they've done a fairly decent job with the character. It's funny, though, when you have these guys where it's just the nature of corporate comics where you're having multiple writers all based on something that one guy had an idea and he leaves before he could do it. So everyone else has to try to figure out their take on it.
Right, yeah. So Mr. Sinister falls into that camp, too, right?
Well, I mean, because Claremont's original view of him was insane. So.
Right? Yeah, he sets up like a bunch of mysteries, and then other writers have to tie up those plot lines.
Because the whole idea with Claremont and Mr. Sinister is that it was Mr. Sinister would be a figment of a creation of a little kid, and that's why he looks like. A typical, like, what a little kid would think a supervillain looked like.
Right.
And his name is as dumb as what a little kid would think.
Yeah. His name, very similar to Apocalypse in it being, like, far too on the nose. And But, yeah, go
and
on.
And that was going to play right into it, and yet it didn't.
Right. Because he never got to write those comics, right?
Right.
Yeah, so then Yeah, because I mean, what I know of Mr. Sinister is that he was, you know, like a scientist from the 19th century or something. And
yeah, yeah.
Is he even a mutant, or is he
just
something
biomorphic,
else?
Like,
yeah, I guess Apocalypse sort of turns him into this, so I guess not.
He was like, yeah, so he doesn't start off as a mutant. He gets altered by Apocalypse into something weird. And then, like, he's got, you know, his whole backstory plays into Gambit in like, very weird and, like, insane ways, too, right?
Yeah, I mean, the original way was one weird way, where basically Sinister was going to be what the little kid came up with as a typical villain, and Gambit was what the little kid came up with as the hero.
Right, right.
And then they were going to fight, but obviously, you know, he left, and that was all dropped.
Oh, wait, oh, so that was, Claremont had a similar plan for Gambit, too, that he was the idea of a child's imagination of a hero?
Of what a hero would be,
oh,
yeah.
Oh, my God, that's so weird. Wow, yeah. I never knew that. Interesting. Okay. Yeah, I mean, do you think Mr. Sinister would translate to the big screen? Like, it feels like they kind of have to get to him at some point, too, because they're running out of, you know, characters in a way.
I think he could, I mean, the idea of a supervillain geneticist, that makes perfect sense.
Right, yeah. He's a little ridiculous in his pure comic book form. I don't know.
Right.
Yeah.
But if you make it, because didn't they, in one of the movies, did they have Essex or something at the end?
I think in Logan they hinted at it. They also hinted at it in another one, too. They might have hinted at it in Apocalypse, too.
But I think
so maybe that would be the way to go.
Yeah.
Nathaniel Essex, have him be that.
Right.
Yeah. If they can do the Joker on the big screen, they can do Sinister on the big screen.
Why, just because they're white, pale-faced?
Well, because they're both kind of garish,
yeah.
You know, and like you, and like the lipstick and like, you know?
Yeah, but Mr. Sinister, I mean, unlike the Joker's like a maniac, and Mr. Sinister is a whole other type of weird villain. I don't know, I think...
They probably dropped the Mr. part of it.
Right.
Yeah,
yeah, that's a good point. Right, they may not even call him Mr. Sinister. They would just—he might just be called Essex, and you're just, you know, led to believe he is Mr. Sinister
or Sinister or
right.
whatever.
Yeah, they do that sometimes. They sort of like weirdly like edit out some of the more ridiculous aspects of certain characters.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so you know, in the meantime, this episode's a little convoluted. Shard is also she. Convinces Forge to let her go back in time to help Bishop. To help the X-Men, because she's trying to help her brother. She's like vaguely, with Forge's help, detected that Forge, that all the time stuff is happening in the northeastern United States in the late part of the 20th century. So that gives her, she knows that she has to find the X-Men. So she ends up in the past. And then the Nasty Boys return again to fight the X-Men. And then, like, weirdly, as they're all fighting, the Nasty Boys abandon Mr. Sinister temporarily. And, like, I thought that was weird. I don't know. That it was just, like, strange for them to just, like, put their thumbs up at Mr. Sinister, who seemingly up to this point has, like, totally controlled them. Like, they worship him like a god.
Well, it turns out, though, that, like, they're all doing the bidding of Apocalypse, and they... And, like, Sinister is having a hard time kidnapping Professor X because all the X-Men are after him.
Right.
So, like, then the Nasty Boys are there, and they're like, oh, getting Xavier was your job, Sinister.
Yeah, like...
We're out of here.
That's like, just weird beat to me.
Yeah.
But still kind of funny. But then they open the time portal for him, so it does seem like the plan is going to work for the bad guys. But Rogue, at the last second, just easily grabs Professor X from Sinister's arms. That was a little strange. We cut to the axis of time, where we see Jean encased in some kind of glass tube, and there's other glass tubes, and she's like, oh, I'm not going to be alone here for long. And she sees Mr. Sinister, and she's like, why did you capture me? And then Apocalypse comes out of the darkness, and he says, because I told him to! Ha 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 ha. And then to be continued. So that's sort of where we're left off on part one. A lot of epicness hinted at, a lot of intrigue yet to be explored. Sonia, I'm going to ask you first, your thoughts on this episode and what you think we have in store here going forward.
I don't know why there was such an online outrage about this episode. I thought it was... par for the course with the way season 4 has been going. I was entertained and intrigued. I really enjoy seeing Egypt in the year 4000. I want to see more of that.
Just like get deep into the world building of Egypt in the year 4000.
I want to see what kind of tech they have.
Right. Well, we saw a weird drone just flying around over the cityscape. So
yeah.
They got something. Brian, your thoughts on this episode?
Like I say, I mean, it was fun, but it was fun in the same way that early 90s X-Men comics were, when they would have these convoluted crossovers bringing every character in tying them all together and not necessarily always making sense.
Right.
But it's cool to have them all together in this big fight. So it captured that spirit very well.
I think that's very well put. I agree with both of what both of you guys had to say. All right. So now, Brian, I want to talk about your upcoming book. Please correct me at every misutterance of ignorance, but has your book been released yet?
Sunday, April 15th, today. I mean, we're recording this.
Right.
That's when it's officially, I think, out.
Congratulations.
Yeah, congrats. Thanks.
You can buy it on Amazon, you know what
right.
I mean?
Okay, well, the podcast is coming out in a week.
23rd, right?
Right, yeah. So fans will have a chance to buy the book by then, which is great. Is this the first book you've written?
No, it's the third.
Oh, wow.
Oh, tell us about the other ones.
The first one is an adaptation of my column for Comic Resources, The Comic Book Legends Revealed.
You're a real bigwig over there, right?
Just at the Cracker Factory.
All right, go on.
Bigwig at the Cracker Factory.
Yeah.
The first one's a collection of Comic Legend Revealed stories. So it's Was Superman a Spy and Other Comic Book Legends Revealed.
Oh, interesting. And then that was your first book?
That's the first book.
Okay,
that's for Penguin. That's for Penguin. Okay. And then the second one was a collection of lists by me and also comic book writers and artists called Why Does Batman Carry Shark Repellent?
Wow, I want to get these books. It sounds really funny.
And other amazing comic book trivia.
Oh, I love it.
What's cool about that, you know, Jeff Johns did a list, Mark Waid, Peter David. So they all supplied some story, Jason Aaron. They would all do, like, Jeff Johns was the best Green Lantern covers, that sort of stuff.
Cool.
Oh, that's awesome.
Dave Gibbons. Yeah.
Are there actually answers to questions such as why does Batman carry shark repellent, or is it just
just because he has to fight off sharks?
You have to repel sharks, right?
Yeah, he has to fight sharks, Sonya. Duh.
The funny thing about that was that that was the first list in the book, and that I thought was fascinating was that there actually was a 1950s Batman story.
Oh,
where,
yeah, no, we've seen that episode of Batman.
No. He's saying that there's a comic book.
Oh, 1950s.
Because you wouldn't think, right? You would think that TV show, the Batman movie
right, would be
but actually, it wasn't a comic book. I'm sure they didn't know that.
Yeah.
I'm sure they did not know that.
It's just what people were thinking about Batman at the time. It just seemed too obvious to all the creators. Like, surely he'd have shark repellent. I'm not surprised multiple people like hit upon that in separate rooms. That's awesome. Hopefully that when fans go out to buy your new book, 100 Things X-Men Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die by Triumph Books, maybe they can buy all three in one of those Amazon package deals. They say,
there on the bottom, right?
Okay, this book, I got an advance copy. Thank you. And your publisher. It's very nice. I read through it. I really, really loved it. I didn't know what to expect whatsoever. Truth be told, don't be offended. Brian, I never heard of you before, so I'm sure you've never heard of us. But it was really, what I liked about it was it was straightforward, it was easy to read, easy to digest, and it was just like a beautiful, modern, like great reference point. In a way, you like a reference book and you summarize the X-Men so well, like the whole span from the beginning to the modern times. Just the way it's organized is just like really wonderful. It's just like a great, like I said, just like a great, like almost like reference book, like for an updated time.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, that's hopefully, I guess, you sort of hope it'd be a primer. It's probably good. If you didn't know about, if you only knew vaguely about the X-Men, I would hope this would be a nice primer to more.
Right, and you know, and what's nice about the book too is if you have a considerable deal of X-Men knowledge, you can sort of jump around to different chapters and brush up on some weak spots of your, you know, history. If like you don't know enough about Wolverine's claws or his healing factor, like you want to know when they introduced his healing factor in the comics exactly, and like why, and like how the power expanded and evolved through time. Like I found that very interesting because that's something I've always wondered. Like I remember reading through the original run of comics and like not remembering where the healing factor really comes into play. So you like you go to those like interesting details. Like I was really impressed by how you honed in on like some just really like cool like storylines and plot points from X-Men history.
Oh, the healing factor, that's the one where basically when he got shot in an early story.
Yeah.
and they draw him getting shot, clearly. The machine gun is torn open his torso, but the editor-in-chief of Marvel thought, that's a little bit too much. Wolverine shouldn't be able to recover from that. So they had him add dialogue saying, oh, the bullet just grazed me. Mm. Even though we see his chest.
Yeah. Well, it's all from a certain point of view, you might say.
It grazed me, right? All the bullets through my chest. It just grazed me, though.
Yeah.
It's a flesh wound.
Right.
It's a flesh wound.
I mean, I'm just reading through the chapter list here. I mean, it's just really great stuff. I mean, just, you know, you've got X-Men reboot films into Kitty Pryde as a subject, into Storm and Rogue as individual subjects. And then you'll jump to, like, authors like Grant Morrison and Joss Whedon, John Cassidy as a team. You know, like the Danger Room.
Is there a certain like subject that's closest to your heart that, or like that you had the most fun writing about as you were going through the book?
I guess, I mean, it's amazing how many different things you could write about Wolverine.
Is he your favorite?
Wolverine gets what, like 5 chapters in there, I think.
Yeah, yeah, he's touched on quite a bit. Is there a favorite character you have, like all time in the X-Men history, or is it just all mushed together in your brain?
I always have a particular attachment to Banshee.
Really? But why so?
Well, I mean, admittedly, when first it was just from Irish American House. He was the only Irish character there was in comics. But but once you adapt that, then you find reasons to like him after that. And it was that, you know, he's a little bit different. He's too old. He's not old enough to be their dad,
right?
But he's too old to like be necessarily their peer.
Yeah.
So he's that weird little thing where none of these guys have lives outside the X-Men.
Yeah.
This guy's lived a whole life before he even joined up with the X-Men.
I mean, I love his backstory. I love that he has like an ancestral castle in his family. I love that, you know, his brother, or is it his cousin, Black
cousin,
Tom?
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes that gets confused, at least in the cartoon. I like that their powers cancel each other out. Now, that's a question I got to ask you. Is it just Havoc and Cyclops and Banshee and Black Tom whose powers don't work on each other, or does that extend to all mutant siblings?
It's interesting. I guess you would think Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch wouldn't be able to cancel each other out.
Yeah, right. That doesn't really make sense. Like, Quicksilver doesn't run slower in the presence of his sister.
Right.
Right, yeah.
And she makes not good bad luck around him, or...
Right, so we don't... It's not set up in a way where we necessarily know if that's a hard and fast rule. That,
well, when the third Summers brothers came, his powers didn't work on Havoc either, so I guess that...
Oh, right. Yeah, it might be a Summers-Cassidy thing, for all we know. yeah, so, I mean, the book really is, like, a blast to read through, and I'm gonna, like, have it, like, close to us as we keep going forward here to, like, you know, to pull from when I need to brush up on some history and some other, like, weird plot details. So it really is a great resource for X-Men fans, and just, you know, if you're new to the X-Men and you're really enjoying them now, if you just like the movies, if you're a comic book fan and you want to know more about, you know, the cartoons or, like, whatever, you know, the creation, for the authors, you know, going back to Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, I mean, your book really, like, touches on everything. And also I'd like to say, Brian, I think your book is, like, well-timed. Because I think we're about to go through another renaissance of X-Men in pop culture and the world in general. Don't you get that sense?
I mean, certainly hope so. But whenever this Fox thing gets settled, even if this Fox thing weren't getting settled, you'd think they'd be headed for a reboot no matter what, right?
Yes. I mean, I really think that once the Fox... Right, yeah. So even if the Fox thing doesn't happen, they've been making better X-Men movies in general, at least in the Deadpool Logan side. So it's kind of exciting to see what Fox has planned for these franchises going forward. You know, they've talked about a Kitty Pryde movie, and they, you know, the New Mutants movie looks kind of interesting. It's a different take, it's like a horror film. So even if it's just left in Fox's hand, it's not that bad. And Legion, the TV show, I think is great. I don't know what your thoughts on it are.
No, I think it's very good, yeah.
Yeah, so I think Fox is really hitting it out of the park with X-Men related things lately. But assuming Disney does take over the franchise, I just have this feeling that they're going to go crazy in making the X-Men their new, like, star vehicle. You know, they'll sort of retire the Avengers a bit from public consciousness, and they'll, like, really make it all about the X-Men. And they're going to think, like, I think they're going to try to make it as big as Star Wars. as in a movie going event. At least that's my hope.
I mean, I would hope so, right? I mean,
X-Men's got, I mean, just, you know, like we've said many times in this podcast, and I'm sure you well know that they were really the premium Marvel product before, you know, the movie era started. They were the most popular by far, like real, just like superstars of the comic book world. And just by the circumstance of the way the movie rights shook out, they kind of, like in recent years anyway, they've kind of sort of become like B players in the public's consciousness of everything.
No, because obviously, because Marvel, it just makes sense that you would want to give more attention to things that you own.
Right, yeah. So I really do believe that, you know, X-Men is on the rise again as a property, as a franchise. I think we're going to get something fabulous out of Disney. I think we're going to continue to get great stuff out of Fox in the time being. And so, like I said, Brian, I think your book is very well timed. I think people are going to really want to learn more about the X-Men as they like continue to get ramped up here in popular consciousness.
Yeah, hopefully.
So, is there any last things you want to say about the book, about yourself, about the X-Men, before we wrap it up here?
I mean, I think the book, 100 Things that really gets the title really gets the whole point across very well.
Yes, I think so too. And I really want to thank you again for coming on the show. You've provided wonderfully accurate and amazing insights, filling in our gaps of befuddled and jumbled knowledge that we have of one of our favorite cartoon shows ever. So I want to do my usual plugs. I want to say you can follow me on Twitter at Willie Simpson. Join the Facebook group, X-Men Task Podcast. Just search us out there if you haven't deleted Facebook yet in a fit of self-righteous rage. Also, you can rate us 5 stars on iTunes and spread the word that way. Brian, is there anything, you know, give the...
Where can people find you?
Yeah, where can people find you and give the book another healthy plug again?
I mean, you'll see me pretty much every day at CBR.com. If you awesome. Go, I guess... You know, if you Google Brian Cronin and CBR.com, you'll find plenty.
Okay, very good. And the book, again, is 100 Things. Let me get this right. 100 Things X-Men Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die by Brian Cronin of Triumph Books. It should be out now by the release of this podcast. Brian, thank you so much. Sonia, any last words?
No, that's about it. Nice Skype meeting you, Brian. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thank you, Brian. Thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.
Okay, all goodbye, right. Everybody.
Goodbye. Okay.